working hard to prepare. And then Rabbi Aaron comes in to speak about halacha. Okay, so this is really, it's not really limited to Tanakh. A lot of what I'm going to say can be applied to halacha because I have to prepare them both the same way. But we'll pretend right now that I'm only talking about Tanakh because that's my topic. What I would like to do is split this up into three different sections. Number one, how... I'm going to sit because this is my teacher's phone. Can everybody see me?
Yeah.
Okay. How to, what you're supposed to do before you start preparing this year, what you need to do when you are preparing this year, and then, of course, what you have to do right before you give this year. That's my goal. Three things, okay? So let's start with what one does before they even start preparing to give a year. Obviously, what you need to do is pick two things. Number one, a topic. Now, that sounds very obvious, but it's not as obvious, because the goal of picking a topic is not just, oh, what do I want to speak about? You have to pick something that you are excited about. If you are going to spend the amount of time to really prepare, you want to give a good share, you got to put a good 10 hours or something into this material, okay? You need to be excited about it. If you're not excited about the topic, throw it out, okay? Or just don't do it. Because if you're not excited, your audience is going to be not excited. And if you're bored by the topic, your audience is going to be bored. So before you even start, you're doomed. So don't pick that topic. If you're actually given a topic that you have to speak about X, Y, and Z, then you need to at least figure out how to twist that topic into something that you are excited about. So number one, you have to pick a topic, and you need to pick a topic you're excited about. Number two, you need to pick a goal. And those are not the same thing, okay? You have a topic, which is, you know, I want to speak in the area of, let's say, Yehuda. Okay, great. But now I need a very specific goal. What am I doing when it comes to Yehuda? And the reason why I say you need to pick a goal is because when you give a shiur, it's very different than giving a class. You can have many goals when you're giving a class. When you're giving a shiur, you have 45 minutes or an hour to get over a very specific point to your audience, and you want your audience to walk away with a complete picture. In order to do that, you need to pick one goal and stick to your one goal from beginning to end so that when you finish, they're like, I know what she was doing, I saw what she did, and I'm coming home with something. If you're throwing four goals at them, they come home going, I have no idea what she just taught me. So you could give the smartest year, you could give the most sources in the world, you could present it incredibly well, but if you have too many goals going on, you will have a very bad year, okay? And people are going to come home not knowing anything that you've just said. Also, in terms of the goal, you need to pick a goal that's appropriate for the audience, meaning if you go in, I once heard a shiur where a woman was, or a girl, or I should say, well, your age, was giving a shiur about the experience of coming home from Israel, and it was to a group of women that were older and could not care less about hearing a shiur about keeping the spirit of Israel alive for my Shana Aleph in Israel. It was very nice and it was very sweet. But it was a very inappropriate message. Your message has to hit home to the people that you're talking to. And in terms of that, I believe very strongly, you never preach to your crowd, okay? Even if you're giving halacha shiur, it is not on you, okay? You're not their rabbi, the rabbi of their shul. You're not a posek. You have no right to preach to the crowd in terms of what they have to do or what they don't. You could present the halacha as it is. I'm sorry, I'm supposed to stick to Tanakh. But in Tanakh, if you're giving a message, you don't have to... You know, you don't have to be like, and therefore the message at the end is never speak Lashon Hara. I don't think that it's, people leave with a very negative tone of, who is she to say that I, and then they, your whole shiur could be genius, and then they leave with this like, who does she think she is? And then your whole shiur is out the door in terms of what they listen. So think very hard in terms of your message, and in terms of who is the audience that you are talking to, also in terms of level of what you say. Okay, so that's what you have to do before you even start preparing. Now you start to prepare the shiur. What is it that you are doing when you prepare this year? So I think that when you prepare a year, there are three steps to preparing a year. I don't think they should mix within each other. I don't think everyone agrees with me, but this is how, personally, I believe very strongly preparing any type of year. Number one, you have to have the creative part of the material collecting and gathering of the year. Number two, you have to have the structuring of the shiur. And then number three, you have to have what I would call the finalizing of the shiur. Let me explain each step and how it goes. Just so, what time do I have to? Who's in charge here?
So, eight.
Okay. Okay. So stage one, the creative part. To me, that's always the most fun. Now, if you try to do stage one being creative with structuring, meaning if as you're looking at material, you're putting it in order of how you're going to teach it, you're limiting yourself to where the shiur could go. When you start a shear, you should not already know where you're going to end. You should not at all. You should be saying, this is my goal, this is my topic. Not only do I want, maybe you'll have some idea of what you might think you want to say, but by the time you're done preparing, you should have tons of more ideas than you ever knew before. So you limit yourself to, oh, this is going to be my point A, and this is going to be my point B when you just start preparing. You are confining yourself. Don't do that. Just be creative. And what's great about the creative stage is you don't know where you're going to go. So you start off with the pasuk, right? Let's say my goal is, we have lots of different goals. My goal is to understand the personality of someone. So what are you going to do? You're going to take this person, you're going to find every single spot that they come up in Tanakh, and you're going to analyze each and every story. Now, as you analyze one story, you might realize in order to understand this story, you really have to understand a different story, even if he's not necessarily in that story. And now you've moved to a totally different place. And there are many times when you're in this creative process, you find yourself for hours somewhere where you never thought you were going to go. And it's awesome, and it's incredible, because it's not like I am confined by what I thought I was going to do. And therefore, it might be that you'll read a mafarish on something, and then you'll jump and you'll be like, whoa, he reminds me of, and you'll start going, you know, you don't know where you're going to go in the creative process, and I think it's really incredible. In general, I mean, I know this is from my class in ambiguity, so I'm not really going to go through this very much, but in general, what you're doing basically in the creative process is, depending on what exactly is your issue. If you're looking at a pasuk, you're looking at numerous psukim, you're looking at a person, whatever it is you're doing, and you're analyzing it on your own, in my opinion, on your own, without looking at anything else other than the psukim. You're then moving outwards, you're looking at context, you're looking at other psukim, and then of course you're looking for parallel stories, and then of course you're going to move on to mafarshim and other things. So the question that everyone always asks me is, how do I get to parallel stories? How do I move beyond my initial, you know, which is easy. I know where my pasuk is. How do I move beyond my pasuk or my parak? How do I move beyond, you know, the three times this comes up in the pasuk that's so easy for me to find? So I think number one is a little bit of a harsh answer, and I apologize, but I think it is true, is that in order to give a good Tanakh shiur, in order to be a Tanakh teacher, you need to have a Tanakh bekias. I'm not saying you have to know every pasuk by heart. I certainly don't. But you need to have a general understanding of how Tanakh goes from beginning to end and the general stories that occurs in all the Sfarim. So yes, sometimes there is no way to find out what's a story that's similar to mine. There's no book that tells you that. There might be a book that will be on Yitzhak, and then if that book will tell you parallel stories to Yitzhak, but there's no, like, parallel story index, you know? Like, there's just no such thing. So the only way that you could do it, it would be nice. Someone wants to write that? Great. If you need to just, this is what I do. I sit and I go, okay, I start from the beginning. I go, okay, Gracie, okay. Adam, no, that doesn't fit my story. No. You just go through, because if you're just like, okay, let me think, what? Like, then you're lost. But if you go through and you think, go through, you can hopefully come up with some. In terms of other things that you can use, obviously the Concordantia is an incredible tool to use. Everyone should know what that is. They have, like, I don't know, a ton of them in the Beit Midrash, big book, hard to miss. And, of course, the Bhagavan CD, which they have for you downstairs in the library. There are pros and cons to each one, and therefore I would suggest you use both. I mean, the Concordantia is so nice because you want to look up a word, you don't know what a word means, or this is a strange word, so you want to see where else it's used to see if you can get a parallel story where that shoresh is used or something like that. So the Concordantia, you have to know the shoresh, which sometimes is hard because sometimes you can't even figure out the shoresh, so then you're kind of stuck with the Concordantia. Then you do a few guesses, and you find it, and then it gives you kind of like a list of all the places where that word comes up. And it does it by conjugation, which is very nice. You can see where is it exactly like the way I saw it, and where is it in other ways. It also helps you to define. It kind of gives you numbers of what it means where, which is very, very nice. The Bar Ilan CD is also incredible. A little bit harder in terms of it gives you a massive amount of information, but it also, it doesn't go by conjugation. It goes just basically in order of Tanakh. You kind of like fly through there. And sometimes it's like you'll look at 1,000 things, you know, so you gotta, it takes a while. Sometimes you scroll through or search better than you research if you come up with 1,000 normally. But there also, you can search Mefarshim. You could search me. I can look for a word in the Mefarshim, which is incredible. So I can find every Mefarsh that's on my Bar Ilan CD, depending on how old or new your Bar Ilan CD, depending on how many mafarshim you have on your Bar Ilan CD, and we didn't put many mafarshim on it, to find where does this word come up in all the mafarshim, or where does they, if you go back to the Shvatim, right, where does it discuss Reuven in all the mafarshim? We can do the same with Midrashim, you know, 100%, which is really tremendous. Now, moving along in terms of things that I like to use the book very much, Otzer Ishei Tanakh. there's a book that's upstairs as well. It kind of gives a midrashic compilation to people in Tanakh. I'm a big fan of analyzing people's personalities, for those who don't know me. And therefore, I find that very useful. Now, Bar Ilan, I can stick in somebody's name, okay, and push midrashim, but I will get 1,000 midrashim. Now, if you want to give a good shir, you go through the 1,000 midrashim. You do. It's fun. It takes days. But you do it. Because you don't know there's some like random midrash that might say the exact cool idea that you were thinking of. And now you have a source to back yourself up. And that's the most powerful thing you could find, right? But if you don't necessarily want to analyze it that much, but you kind of want to get an overview of what Chazal says on somebody, then certainly the Otzer Isha Tanach is a really nice compilation, which I really like to use. It's very easy to use as well. And the other book that I think everyone should own and everybody should look at all the time when giving a Tanach shir is the Dot Mikra Atlas, or any atlas. It sounds to me that's a very, very good one, because there is a lot of Tanach where if you don't have a map and you don't have an understanding of how the land works, you miss out on a tremendous, tremendous amount of information. I'll remember, I'll never forget once, it was years ago, I did a shir on the War of the Four and Five Kings, and all I did was bring a map, okay? Man, I'm prepared, I promise. But I brought a map, that was like the Bichidish, and we just traced where the places were and how it worked, and it just gave a totally different idea to a story that really is a little bit confusing and made it really very clear. So maps are really, really significant, especially if you're learning Yoshua or Shoftim or something that you can't get anywhere without a map. So those are the books that I really find significant in terms of helping along when you kind of like get stuck and you're like, okay, well let me now look at this word in all these different places, or let me see where this location is and maybe that'll help me in terms of other things. On top of that, you obviously need to use the Mefarshim. I know that was my last year's topic, so I don't know how many of you were here last year. I discussed in this thing how to use Mefarshim in a Pshat Shir, which I think you certainly need to do. But I think a lot of times the mistake people do is that they limit themselves to the Mefarshim found in Mikros Gedolot. There's a lot more Mefarshim out there than Jaz, Rashi, Ben Ezra, and Bach. They're awesome, okay? But you need to use the Malbim, the Abarbanel. You just look at Chum Leila, the first time. I mean, I've been long forever in terms of what you could use. It's all upstairs in the Beit Midrash. You can find it in the wider library. You can own them if you buy them. You know, that's all good. But I think that you miss out on so many crazy different perspectives if you don't look at a lot of different things. Whenever I prepare a shir, when I'm done with all my analysis, I just go through one book at a time. I mean, I thank God, collected quite a library. So I, one book at a time, just, oh, no, he's the same as this guy. Oh, this is different. You know, that's how you have to do it. And then you pick from there in terms of what you want to keep in your shir and what you don't. But you need to at least have the information to have the ideas to put into your shir. And now, of course, we have online. I mean, online is a whole new world of information that if you're giving a shir, you need to use online. You need to look at the VBM or other things, Virtual Beit Midrash Online, which has crazy amounts of Torah online, which is really very, very powerful. In terms of using Mefarshim, you need to use them. You need to use them to support yourself and back yourself up. You need to use them to give other perspectives, because giving one perspective in a shir, nobody wants that, because what if I don't like your perspective? So now I leave your shir saying I thought the shir was dumb, right? So you can't have that. You got to give lots of perspectives within a shir, and sometimes your entire shir is just Mefarshim, and that's a good shir too, but it's only a good shir if you analyze the Mefarshim. If I say to you, I have a problem in the text, and here are five ways to solve. The Ramban says this, Rashi says, that's not a good shir, okay? A shir is, Rashi says this, Ibn Ezra is reacting to Rashi and Pesukim, trying to figure out what Pesuk it is that they're using, why is it that they're saying what they're saying, that's a good shir in terms of an analysis of the Mefarshim. So this is the creative stage. You just go crazy, the best. I mean, stopping the creative stage is when it gets hard, and normally that's when your deadline's getting closer, because then you're like, okay, I have to stop. And normally, thank God, so much information out there, you never want to stop in the creative stage of your shir. But then it's time to start structuring. So when you say, okay, I think I have enough information, let me start figuring out now what I'm going to do with this year. And obviously you have to think about what have you come up with. Have you come up with three answers? Have you come up with two answers? What have you come up with to figure out what your shir is about? But the number one thing that you do when you start structuring your shir, and this is the hardest part, is cutting. Cutting information. A lot of times when you prepare shirim, you come up with information that you think is the coolest thing you ever heard, but it has nothing to do with anything in your goal, in your thesis, nothing. You have to learn to cut it. You have to learn to say, this is very nice, maybe I'll create an entire new shir surrounding this information for another day, but I gotta cut it for my shir, because what to you is so cool, to everyone else who's listening to you, it's distracting. And all of a sudden they're like, why is she there? What is she doing? And then they've lost you, and you're completely lost. loss. So the first thing you gotta do is start cutting, 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 cutting. Obviously, if you realize you've cut too much or you don't have enough, you go back to stage one. But assuming that you have enough, now you start structuring. The way you structure a SHEAR is you take your goal. You start with your goal. Your introductory statement in front of the crowd is, this is what I am going to accomplish. Sometimes people feel when they're giving a SHEAR, it's very elementary. You have to do this. You have to tell the audience, what am I about to accomplish when I'm giving you the SHEAR? So they're listening out for it. And as the SHEAR is going on, you are continuing to review. You say to them, I'm going to give you, you're not as weird like this, I'm giving you a SHEAR on, but my topic is da-da-da, here's my goal, I'm going to give you four answers. And then when you finish your first answer, you say, that was answer number one to the problem of here's answer number two. And then at the end of the SHEAR, you do a wrap-up. And even though you think, like, why am I saying, you have to do this because this is what gives a good SHEAR. And you end up saying, I gave you four different approaches to the answer up, and in a very quick summary, you summarize up what you've done. That is a vadai in terms of what you have to do to structure a SHEAR so that the audience is coming with you on your ride, on your journey, or else they're lost because they're like, where did she go? Why is she talking about that? You need to, this is answer number three. And many times when you're doing these other answers, you're going to different places. So you will lose them if you don't make sure to keep bringing them back in and refocusing them on, this was answer number three, and now I'm moving on to number four. So that's part of, I guess, number two, which is very significant, which is smooth transitions. When you're giving a share, you need to make sure every time you switch from one topic to the next, or one detail that you're discussing to the next, there's a smooth way of making sure it transitions so you don't lose the people that are listening to you by them saying, why is she doing that? And of course, I think number three for every share, there needs to be what I would call the wow moment. And you need to play up your wow moment, which is the time where you're giving either your favorite or the most unique answer to the question that you have just presented. And if you're doing it that way, then normally what you do is you start from, here's one way of creating a wow moment, okay? You start from, you have a number of answers, you start from the more, you know, well-known answers to more unique, and then you have that pivotal moment where it's like, here's my crazy, you know, interesting idea that's either my chiddush or a crazy chiddush that I found in the Bar Benel that's just so cool, but you build to it, so it creates a wow moment. That's what you want in a SHEAR where everyone goes, ah, oh, and everything fits together. Or, let's say you have a SHEAR where you have two opposing perspectives. You can look at this person this way, you can look at this person this way. You can look at a pasuk one way or the other. Your wow moment is then when you at the end go, and you can look at it as both of them mixed together, and you give that other perspective, and it's like, oh, okay, got it. If you try and make the wow moment too much in the beginning, it's not a wow moment, and then you have nothing. And the rest of the share is like, so, like you said that already. Yeah, that's boring. You gotta build, you gotta figure out what's your wow moment, and build to that wow moment. And sometimes the wow moment, as I was saying before, you know, doesn't have to be a new theory. It could be a parallel story even. You know, like let's say you find this awesome parallel that fits what you're saying so well. So you do your whole thesis and then you're like, and this is just like so-and-so. And you build this awesome parallel, you make a beautiful chart, and you show it to the crowd, and then they're like, oh, they're eating. I mean, they're eating out of your hand. That is what you have to do in this year. So you have to be very well structured. You have to make sure not to lose your crowd because then you've lost it, okay? You have the best information, you lose your crowd, you're done, okay? So you gotta make sure to, even if you're like, but I said this four times, you've got to do it again. Not too much that they feel like you're talking down to them, but, and quick, you know, you're not spending 10 minutes on reviewing, but, and then you're moving on to your wow moment, and with your wow moment, that's your pivotal moment, and then, of course, you move to your conclusion, where you sum up everything that you've done. So really, in this creative, this structured, I guess, the way you're structuring your SHEAR, you're making sure there's no excess material, you're making sure you have good transitions, and you're making sure you have this wow moment. That's really what you're looking for in terms of structuring. And then, of course, we move to what I would say stage three. Stage three is finalizing your SHEAR. And I think a lot of people make a mistake that they don't do stage three. They stop at stage two. I've structured my SHEAR. I think I'm done. It looks great on paper. I'm great. And they don't do stage three, and you can give a really bad SHEAR because paper doesn't speak. So if you think your SHEAR is good on paper, that doesn't mean it's going to translate well when you're giving it to the crowd. What do I mean? Number one, I think in terms of finalizing your SHEAR, is writing out for yourself a very final either outline, or some people even write out word for word what they're going to say. It really depends on you in terms of exactly how you're going to say it. It might be a very nice picture to you, but you need to figure out exactly how you're going to word and say what you're going to say. And also realize people are human. You blank out when you give shiurim all the time because you're in the moment and you're getting very excited and then you're like, oh my gosh. And in your brain, you're like, what's mine supposed to say next? And you start panicking and everyone's like, and you're, the worst thing you can do is, you know, that's the worst. you know, you can't do that. So you need to have what to look down on, and whenever I give a share, or when I give a class, I bold things on my paper. So I can look at that word and refocus myself if I'm losing something. So if you look at my sheet right now, I have smooth transition, wow moment, you know? So I'm not reading what I'm writing, because that's not, if you read when you give a share, that's also a very bad share, okay? So you need to be able to say, it's on there, but I'm not being able to read it while I'm giving it. I gotta have something that just, oh, that's my next point, okay? So that's why I like outlines, and I like bolding and underlining, so you just look down and you know what you're up to next. Also realize in terms of blanking out, if you forget to say something, okay, it's, unless it's so important to your share that without saying it, your whole share is not going to make sense, forget it. Just forget it. You missed it. Obviously, it wasn't important enough for you to say it the first time, which is why you missed it. Move on, because saying to the crowd, wait, I forgot something, let me go back. Again, you've lost them, okay? So that's why you want to have a final version well done in front of you. That's step one. But step two, I think you got to take it even further. When it comes to a sheer, I'm not saying in terms of a teacher, though. I think every teacher, if they did this, I don't. I wish I did. I read over my notes before I come to class every day, but I don't say it out loud. I think you're a better teacher if you had that time. I don't know who does. But when you give a sheer, must. It's an absolute. You must practice your sheer out loud, because delivery is half of giving a sheer, okay? I mean, the information is obviously the other half, but the way you deliver it and how you say it and the way you word things is part of the sheer as well. You must say it out loud. You can say it out loud to someone and then get ready for some critique back, but it doesn't need to be that way. You can just say it to yourself, because a lot of times when you're saying it out loud, you're listening to yourself and you're like, wait, that didn't sound right, or wait, that didn't go well, like that, and then you fix yourself. So even if on paper it looks awesome, when you're talking, you hear things that you won't notice in your head when you're looking at it on paper. So absolute, you must practice when you're giving a sheer. The other reason to practice when giving a sheer is that they give you time when you give sheer in. You're always very timed. It's very pressuring. Okay, always wear a watch too. But you have 45 minutes. You have an hour. Now I have half an hour. But if you don't get to finish your sheer, okay, that's not a very good sheer, okay? If you don't get to your final point, or you don't get to really do the full picture, your sheer's not going to be very good. So in terms of practicing, part of practicing is to make sure you can conclude your entire share within the amount of time that they have given you. And if not, you got to now go back and start cutting things out, because you got to get the ending in. You know, because some people, once, even if, yes, technically, they're not going to necessarily walk out on you, once a certain amount of time has passed and they know the share is over, people get antsy and people don't keep listening, okay? Even if your share is awesome, they're not going to keep listening. So therefore, make sure that you practice so you know exactly how long your share is going to take. Also, in terms of finalizing your share, finalizing source sheets. I think people don't give enough significance to source sheets. For example, if you're giving sources, then you should give source sheets so people can read them. People don't have to necessarily read them, but I think you should have them. And I think it's very distracting when you give a source sheet that you have people have to flip back and forth and then they can't find the source. Be organized. Put time into your source sheet, okay? It's part of your share. It's very significant. Put the sources in order. Number your sources. So you could be like source 10 as opposed to where am I looking? Are people getting lost? And make them look nice. Sometimes you see people's source sheets and it's like it's not inviting. Okay, make your source sheet feel inviting. So that's preparing your share, okay? You're going to have three steps. The creative part of it, which is, I think, the most fun ever. And then the structuring, which is a little bit more limiting. And then the finalizing, which is sometimes very hard also, to have that final point. But it's something, all three steps that you really have to do. And then, of course, you have to go and give the share. So when you're going to give a share, I think, Tanakh share, Halakha share, it doesn't matter which one it is. First of all, I think one should practice it or look it over right before you give a share. Because when you're giving a share, you don't want to be like, So if you practice it right before, that's very helpful. Number two, making a joke sometimes is very good. Lighting the mood is very good. Also for you, because then you feel a lot calmer. If you're very nervous, everyone can kind of tell that you're nervous. And that comes off in terms of your share as well. I also find in terms of giving a share, just a few helpful hints, is that if you take too many questions when you give a share, your share does not come out well. And I'll explain why. Because people take you off topic, and then you lose focus, and then people start daydreaming because they don't really care about the question that was being asked, and then you completely lose your crowd. I find when I'm giving a share, especially if it's a time share that has to be 45 minutes to an hour, it's not the same, obviously, for class, but for share, I don't take questions, okay? I'll take a question of someone who's very confused and they just want me to repeat something that I just said, but in terms of giving a share, I think it's much better if someone raises their hand and say, I would love to take your question, but I have to finish in an hour. Let me take your question after share is over, or let me take your question privately afterwards. It avoids the losing of everybody else for this one sacrifice, one person. And also sometimes, I hate to say it, when you call on someone, there are many times that you will hit people in share that try to rip into you, and that's always very hard when you're giving a shear, and then someone tries to rip into you to continue on in that shear. So is it the way to avoid it, or the way to just stop it? Say, you know what, let me talk to you later. I don't really want to go into this now. Let me finish my shear. And there are also sometimes people that just want to say things. You know, they like to say things. And it's like, yeah, okay, very good. So it's just easier if you kind of cut it off, because again, you lose your audience that way, and you also lose out on the time that you have. So that's something that's very important. Obvious, I mean, this is obvious in terms of giving a shear. Look at your audience, make eye contact with your audience. Do not read off the sheet of paper in front of you. That is very boring. And my best advice about giving a shear for you is just start giving them. Start giving them. It doesn't matter where or what or for whatever reason. Just start giving. The more you give a shear, the more practice you have, the better you will be at giving a shear. When you give a shear, it happens to be, for good or for bad of that, people come over to you afterwards and they tell you what they think. Okay? They will. And they come over to you and they will tell you if they liked it, which is very nice to hear, but they will tell you if they don't like it. And instead of getting annoyed by that, learn from it. People will come over and say, well, I didn't like when you said this because the learn from it, okay? Meaning say, okay, let me hear why. Or people will come and give you suggestions. Sometimes they'll help you even add to your share because they'll think of things that you haven't. So in that sense, you automatically have that critique right there, but sometimes, you know, you don't necessarily enjoy getting that, so it's something they realize you will get when you give a share, because people certainly do come over and tell you what you think, so realize that, but keep giving them. The more you give, the better you will get at giving a share. So at the end of the day, what I would say at 1 minute here is that what you need to do to give a good Tanakh share, put in the time, I mean, last time when we had this panel, all three of us that were on the panel decided that it takes us a good 10 hours to prepare a good Tanakh shiur. And I think it could be more than that sometimes. But 10 hours, we're not talking about 3 hours and I pop out a shiur. Absolutely not. You want to give the shiur, you need the time. You need the time to prepare the shiur. And obviously, again, it has to be something that you are so excited about that you want to put 10 hours of your time into. Focus a lot of attention also on structuring and transitioning, as I said before, and practice. You must practice your presentation 100%. But at the end of the day, just my final message on this point, is that you have to remember when you're giving a shiur, you are teaching Torah. And there is a high to teaching Torah. It's exciting. It's really exciting, the thought of I'm giving over this information that might inspire someone else. And what I find sometimes when you give a shiur, you get so nervous about what you're doing, you don't enjoy the moment. And when you don't enjoy the moment, I'll be honest, your shiur won't be as good either, but you don't enjoy the moment. It's such a chaval. I mean, think about what you're doing. It's incredible. People are coming to listen to hear what you have to say about this piece of information of Torah, and you're trying to tell them something that's going to inspire them or give them a perspective they never thought before. Be in your moment, you know? Like, don't be that person who steps out of their body and is watching themselves. Be in it, be in the moment, and learn to enjoy it, because it's really the best experience getting shared. Yeah.
I think we're going to have questions afterwards for the panel. Thank you so much. Thank you so much. Our next speaker is Rav Aaron Cohn. Rav Aaron Cohn will be speaking more on the perspective of giving a halacha shiur. Rav Aaron Cohn has smicha from Reef, is a rav in Paris, Israel, and say, New Jersey. And teaches many halakha classes in... Yeah, people can come up, by the way. Those people in the back can come up. So thank you.
Okay. I thoroughly enjoyed this type of presentation. Mine is going to be different in that, first of all, I want to thank Rosenbaum for asking me to speak. It's really a pleasure, and it's a pleasure to see so many of you who come out with the goal of having a little bit of a better grasp of how it is to present Torah, different subjects in Torah to different kinds of audiences. I'm going to try to focus upon halacha, which, as you'll hear over the course of my presentation, has its own constraints in that you're bound, in a sense, to adhere to certain rules and regulations, and you always have to try to be careful about presenting things in an accurate way, about balancing things, about providing the right kind of emphasis. So therefore, I'm going to restrict my presentation to halacha per se. Okay? So in any case, it's a little bit, in a sense, it's narrow. It's very different in certain ways. Some things which I'm going to say are going to be very different than, let's say, presenting a shiur machshava. very different than presenting a shiur in Tanakh. Again, one is bound and constrained a little bit more in certain kinds of ways. So first of all, the first thing, and I mentioned three different things that a person might think about in preparing a shiur. This actually is not only in regard to halacha, but in regard to any subject. And that is sort of like to check off three different things to think about. First of all, is to know the audience that you're going to be speaking to. Who are they? What is their background? What do they know, and what can they absorb of what you're going to be, what you're going to try to convey to them? In halacha, there are a lot of different concepts, a lot of different ideas that are necessary in order to understand halacha properly. A person will mention a concept of a safek min haTorah l'chumra, safek min rabbana l'chula, a sveik sveika, and many other such kinds of concepts. And if, let's say, for example, you're introducing one such concept to an audience and explaining it and letting them absorb it, and then you're going on, it's one thing. If you have to introduce three or four such concepts to a given audience because they're not so familiar with it, and they're going to pile up one on top of the other, they're trying to assimilate into their thinking these new concepts, and then you're also providing all the material and all the substance that you're conveying as well, you have a lot more difficult. You have to know how much the audience is able to absorb. You also have to know what they're interested in, what they want to learn. In other words, you can have a particular audience where you say, you know what, this is what I want to teach them, but that's not what they're interested in. So that's also an important thing to think about when thinking about who your audience is. I remember one time I heard Rav Lichtenstein, a number of speakers talking about the legacy of the Rav Zatzal, Rav Soloveitchik, and Rav Lichtenstein mentioned something about Rav Soloveitchik that I found to be incredibly powerful. He said that the Rav had an amazing koach hatzimtzum. Now, tzimtzum is a concept which, first of all, we're not talking about Kabbalah now. I don't think anybody's talking about Kabbalah. So in any case, but it has Kabbalistic overtones, first of all, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu created the world, and it's through koach hatzimtzum, he was mitzamtzim himself. But there is, based upon that, it's a concept which has, which resonates with tremendous meaning. He said the Rav had this koach hatzimtzum where the Rabbi said it was a towering giant who knew really Kol HaTorah Kula and knew some of the aspects of Torah that are much more, from our perspective here in North America, in Manhattan, seem to be much more esoteric, seem to be much more removed from our everyday existence. You say, we're having a shiur about brachos. Oh, I want to know about brachos. We're having a shiur about, let's say, for example, the nesachim, which they offered in the Beis HaMikdash, right? It'll take place tomorrow night. How many people are showing up? Not to understand practically how they did it, but to understand the conceptual underpinnings of every single aspect of the Avodah. So the Rav, when he was growing up, he said, that's what he learned. He learned with his father, based upon the methodology of his grandfather, specializing in kutchim and taros, things that nowadays we have no connection to. These are the kind of things he knew, he would dream about these things. He woke up and went to sleep with these concepts and these ideas and these halachos, which he constantly pondered and thought about. And then he said, this was an incredibly, incredible anecdote, he was sitting in the Rav Shir, and he was learning what's referred to as Moed, and Noshim, and Ezekiel. He developed this impression that the Rav specializes in these different starting of Mishnayis and of Gemara, of Moed, Noshim, and Ezekiel. And all of a sudden, one summer comes along, and the Rav starts speaking about giving Shir on the Avodas Yom HaKippurim, various different, all the details, all the halachos and the concepts and every single detail of the avodah of the Kohen Gadol on Yom Kippur. And now all of a sudden he said, I didn't know the Rav knew about this also. Not only did the Rav know about it, he said, but the Rav, this was what the Rav knew better. This was what we call in the language which is used as Girsa D'Yankusa. This is what he learned as a child. This is what he knew about better than anything else. This was the aspect or the area of Torah he was most familiar with. And he said, did he focus upon that when he came to North America? You go to Briscoe, for example, Yerushalayim, they're still teaching, kutchim largely. Those are the mesechtas they learn, because that's the mesorah, that's the tradition in the family. That's what they learn first, that's what they know best. He said, the Rav left that behind. And he said, what am I going to teach the American boys? What are they going to be able to learn? What are they able to absorb? And therefore, in terms of what he chose to teach year after year, semester after semester, summer after summer. And in terms of the subject matter of a given shiur, in terms of how he would teach a given subject, right? And let's say, for example, in Moed or Noshim and Ezekiel, he said he had koach hatzimtzum. he could have overwhelmed everybody, and everybody would have said, I lost him after 10 minutes. It was incredible the first 10 minutes. And then he was going, and everybody would have been overwhelmed that they would have been talking about how the Rebbe is so incredible, we don't understand it. But the Rebbe didn't want that. The Rebbe wanted his audience to be able to follow and to be able to be uplifted in terms of their level of learning, and so that he could mentor them and he could teach them how to learn and how to analyze Torah on a higher level. But on the other hand, he had to restrain himself in order to be able to do so. That Kochat Simsum is very important. It seems like somebody's going into a fourth or a fifth grade class, and they have all these incredible ideas they want to be able to convey, and to hold back. And hold back what Mr. Price was referring to before about cutting out things that's sometimes relevant when figuring out what is the audience able to absorb. Sometimes when I've talked, at times I've taught a certain subject matter with last semester, anybody was in the class, I don't want to be frowning here, but in any case, in regard to Melechus Machshavas, when I taught Melechus Machshavas, there's an inherent complexity in that particular subject in halacha. I found that certain aspects of the discussion sometimes would be very difficult. And maybe, said to myself, maybe I should have been mitzamtzem a little bit more. Maybe I should have cut out a little bit more. Maybe I should have left out some of the conceptual elements which I was introducing into things. So first of all, know your audience well. Think about what they're going to hear, about what they're going to be absorb. Secondly, in this checklist, this brief checklist, is know what your goals are. When teaching halacha, and again, I'm narrowing myself to halacha. There are various different types of halacha shiur. There's the kind of halacha shiur where, let's say, for example, in Pesach, a few weeks ago before Pesach, I decided to give a shiur, which I hadn't really given before, halachas which relate to the Seder. And I didn't have, like, 4 or 5 hours. I didn't have multiple shiur. I decided to do it all in one shot for about an hour and a half, or a little bit more, and I was going to discuss an overview of things that people should know about at the Seder. And the people that were interested, that's how it was marketed, the people who were interested in knowing details about what to do with the Seder, what not to do with the Seder, how to describe the Seder, things that people might not be attentive to, that would be the group of people that would come. And then, in that case, what you have to do is, you have to really restrict yourself in terms of how much you're able to explain the halacha, because you have a very short timeline. You're trying to go through briefly a lot of different halachos all at the same time, and within, again, a particular framework. It can be a shir, let's say, for example, Baruch Rishona, or in regard to Baruch Achrona, or in regard to halachos of the Seder, it can be halachos of Sefirot HaOmer. You say you have an hour, and you want to be able to do things right quickly. And you say to yourself, you have to leave out a lot of the explanation. At the other end of the spectrum, you can have a very different goal. You can have a shir, let's say, for example, on the topic of what happens if you miss one day in Sefirot HaOmer, and all the conceptual background in regard to it. You can speak for an hour about that, and it'll be a fascinating shir. It would have practical ramifications as well, not only in regard to that subject, but you could then say, and this has ramifications in regard to this other question, this other question, this other question as well. It's a very different type of shir. And then obviously you have to prepare it totally differently. You have to know the kind of shir that you're preparing. You have to know the goal. You want them just to know halacha lemaisa in regard to something, and then you want to run through, let's say, for example, 15 or 20, 30 halachos, let them know. Well, or do you want to focus on one or two different subjects and analyze it in more detail? One thing which is very important, also, especially in maybe a little bit more so in terms of halacha, is you have to know yourself. You have to know your audience, you have to know your goal, in terms of what you want to teach, and you have to know yourself. What am I able to teach? It should not be once or twice that a person should say to themselves, I really want to teach this, I don't think I'm qualified. I really want to teach this, and you know what? I might be able to, in quotation marks, get away with it, but I really shouldn't be teaching that particular subject. I can say about myself, there are areas of halacha where, like, somebody talk about that, I'll bring somebody else in. There are important rabbanim that I know about, who, let's say, for example, whenever they get a call, in the area of halacha called choshen mishpat, right, that has to do with civil law, that has to do with monetary issues, significant, amit ha'chanim, they say there are people who specialize in this area, ask somebody else. Could this person get away with answering this question? The answer is yes, but it's not the right thing to do. To pick a particular subject you'll be able to get away with, but you won't be able to answer the questions, and you won't be able to, and this we're going to get to in just a moment, you won't be able to present it in the right fashion. You won't be able to have confidence you presented the nuances correctly. In that case, choose a different shiur, or have somebody else give it. That now, sometimes you have, let's say, you're stuck. And so, let's say, for example, this is the class, or the audience, or the group of people, and they have, sometimes, okay, and then you do your best. And then what you do is you have to try to make sure that you're presenting it properly, and if you're not sure that there's a particular halacha and how to present the views of the poskim properly, you consult with somebody else. But it's very important this would be true in any area of Torah, but especially in halacha, the stakes are very high. You have to know yourself and what you're capable of teaching. You should try to make sure that you stay within those constraints that you have in terms of what you know and what you're able to teach about. Okay. Now, in terms of personal preference, I just want to mention something for a moment. And this is something where you're able to, when you have the luxury to be able to, I always prefer to be able to present halacha and give background for it. The different various levels and gradations of how much background you give to, in regard to a particular halacha. But at least the basic understanding of where the halacha came from. I remember one time I met a young lady many years ago who said to me the following statement, which intrigued me. She said, "I'm not good at halacha." It's a categorical statement, "I'm not good at halacha." So I asked her what she meant. "What do you mean you're not good at halacha? What does that mean? Like, it's a mental block? What is that exactly?" So she said, "Well, you know, I sit in halacha class." Very bright young lady. Sat in halacha class, and is not in any way criticism in a particular seminary. She said they learned halacha, they learned a lot of Hilchos Shabbos, and she's just not good. She doesn't remember. So I said, "How did the halacha class work?" So she said, "Okay, these are halachas in regard to your hands. These are halachas in regard to your hair. This is halacha in regard to your face. This is halacha in regard to your every. This is halacha in regard to how you walk. This is halacha in regard to how you sit. This is halacha in regard to." In other words, basically, in regard to every single, you know, aspect of life, it would be like, this is aser, this is mutter. Got that? Just one second. Okay. This is mutter, this is aser. The next thing, this is mutter, this is aser. This is aser, this is mutter, this is aser, this is mutter. She said, "I couldn't remember anything." So I said, "That's not being bad halacha. It's just you don't have a photographic memory. How are you supposed to remember aser, mutter? Wait a second. That was mutter. That was aser. How are you supposed to remember anything? There's no rhyme or reason. They didn't tell you the reason for anything. They didn't tell you what malacha is, what zala. May not turn it to be drab bon on it. Makes sense. It doesn't make sense. Doesn't make a difference. They told you about their mother. Of course you're not. Nobody's good at halacha if that's what, how halacha is done. So I have a very strong preference, which, by the way, some of the time, you have to give a certain shear. There are people who say, "I want to know what's aser and mutter in the following area on Shabbos." Okay, might be a place for that at times. Generally, by and large, to present halachas without rhyme or reason, I think is a tremendous mistake. On multiple levels. Number one, because it means that people generally will not remember what they learned because they don't understand it. It also very often presents a total distortion of halacha. "I learned that's aser. I can't believe this. They're violating the halacha. I can't believe this." They don't realize it's a chlokas aposkim. Okay, so maybe they presented the more machmir opinion, but to know, just to say that it's aser, many times we get to some errors that come up as a result of the simplification of halacha over and over again. But if you're just presenting black and white, aser, mutter, right? So as a result of that, you very often end up with a very distorted view of how things work. People very often, I will say this, I see this over and over again, will sometimes look aghast at what other people are doing. "I can't believe this." And then, if they ask me the question, I'll say, "Well, they're probably doing it because of the following. Oh, I didn't realize, I was only told aser," not realizing that there are other points of view. So that's another reason why presenting the halacha very briefly is not a good idea. Number one, because the fact that it, again, doesn't allow the person to understand halacha properly very often ends up in distortions of halacha, and also ends up very often with people having critical views of other Jews who are doing things differently, not realizing that sometimes what they're doing differently might be rooted in valid sources as well. Now, I'm just going to briefly touch upon something which Mr. Price mentioned as well, in regards to sources. And really, it can depend upon a number of different variables in terms of which sources one would use in teaching a class in halacha, how many sources, how often to refer to them. I very often myself, when teaching a class, have a struggle in regard to this because, on the one hand, I'd love to be able to go through all the sources and look at them inside. And there's an expression which is used, osios machimos, that if you present a beautiful, long, bir halacha of the Mishnah Berurah in regard to a complex topic and you read it inside from beginning to end, so then you have an understanding of the gadlus of the Mishnah Berurah, of the nuances of the topic, of the various different views and how he's able to analyze them. Summarizing that bir halacha will never be the same as the bir halacha itself. And then on the other hand, some reading through the entire bir halacha in detail, if it's long enough, might take up the entire class. So you have to try to figure out how to balance. This is when you come back to goals. Are your goals, let's say, for example, is your goal simply to convey the halacha? Do you have such limited time that you simply have to convey the halacha, you don't have enough time to read through the sources? Can you make a brief reference to some of those sources? Or sometimes, and this is I personally try to strike some kind of balance, do you make reference to the sources at least in order to be able to give a sense of the sources, to be able to give a sense of how the poskim themselves, in their own words, dealt with a particular subject. Again, there are various different ways of approaching it, and that goes back to the goals. Is it a class which is supposed to be an in-depth analysis of a particular halacha, in which case, obviously, there would be much more reason that you would want to use the sources in order to be able to do that, in order to present that. If you're giving the short, you know, bullet points of how to go through the Seder, then the sources are probably not as relevant and not as helpful. So again, in a situation where you're trying to come to some kind of middle ground, what you would do is try to balance out, figure out how much do you want to cover, what are your goals, what do you want to convey, how much do you want to teach, not only in terms of the material itself, but in terms of, let's say, for example, skills and familiarity with sources. And then, once you figure out what your goals are, then you will use the appropriate sources accordingly. Okay. Now, I'm going to talk a little bit about a few different things to know about in halacha in general. This is true in terms of understanding halacha in general, and true in terms of especially when one is trying to teach halacha. In halacha, first of all, you have to know that nuance is critical. You have to know that when presenting multiple different points of view, in a sense more, not because it's not important in other areas of Torah as well, but it's more important in halacha to know which sources you're presenting, which ones are more important, which ones are less important, which ones carry more weight, which ones carry less weight. Sometimes you have a situation where a person is presenting a particular halacha, and you can sometimes have a presentation of the words all are presented in a sense accurately, but on the other hand, the nuances are missing. You can have a situation, let me give a couple of examples in regard to this, where nuance can be critical in terms of understanding halacha properly. Let's say somebody will say, and it's often repeated, an error which is often repeated, that let's say, for example, you know, women don't make adol. It's well known that women do not make adol, which probably many of you would have heard. Women don't make adol. And it's very often presented as a categorical statement, for which reason sometimes the rabbi will get a shayla, a woman is stuck somewhere or another, and there's nobody to make abdallah for her, so what should she do? So the halacha is very clear that that women absolutely, 100%, do make abdallah. They do make abdallah. There's a source in the Ramah that says that women generally don't make abdallah, and then ultimately when you work through the various different sources, then you figure out that there's this minog, and it's only a minog, something about the women not drinking from a kos. And somehow, in the translation of the halacha, when it was presented and passed on, because of this Ramah, because of this custom, and it's only a custom that women didn't drink from the coast of Abdallah, all of a sudden there was this presentation where somebody said, don't make Abdallah. One person said to a daughter or to his student, don't make Abdallah, women don't make Abdallah, and then it was repeated over and over and over again, and all the nuances were lost. And then it was turned into, women don't make Abdallah, it's chok v'lo yavor, it's like Yehoreg v'lo yavor, women absolutely don't make Abdallah. Sometimes I have to convince the woman to make Abdallah, it's like you would think, please make Abdallah. Please make Abdallah. You have to make Abdallah. The halacha says you have to make Abdallah. And really, she does have to make Abdallah. And I feel like finally convinced her that, you know, according to almost all the Rishonim, you have exactly the same obligation to Abdallah as men. And they explain why it is that this, but very often, because of the simplification of the halacha, because the nuances are missing, so you'll have a presentation which is a total distortion. One of the other situations where this comes up, where you have, again, a distortion, where the nuances can be critical, where, again, just like in regard to Havdalah, so preferably women should make Havdalah. That is true, after all is said and done. So that turned into, all of a sudden, a woman is not able to make Havdalah. Another example that comes up in regard to Pesach, which weighs on me enormously, is that very often people will learn, whether they learned it in high school, they learned it in seminary, they learned it because they bought a particular book or a certain page. This is how much matzah you're supposed to eat. So then it turns into, okay, so this Maisa Shahaya. This happened last year with two different women in my community. One was a graduate of Stern College, where she was sitting at somebody's table, somebody who was a learned person, and the person with a stomach condition, a digestive condition, and she asked the people at the tables, how much am I supposed to eat? So they point to the page, or whatever it is exactly that in front of them. This is how much matzah you're supposed to have. And then as a result, she was sick, mouse, like really ill, the first day of Pesach, in enormous distress. So that's the kind of thing which, obviously everybody was unintentional, that was prohibited according to any standard of Torah. Any standard of Torah and Allah was absolutely prohibited. It was one of these that was referred to the Chumra, the Asir, the Kula, by trying to be Machmir, end up being lenient. She was just Mevatel. Unfortunately, she didn't intend it, they didn't intend it, her Simchas Yom Tov. She didn't enjoy the fulfillment of the mitzvah whatsoever. And it was in order to be Machmir for a certain position, which we, if a person is healthy and able to on Pesach, the person should eat a larger share of matzah. Of course, the person should try to eat a larger share of matzah if, according to some poskim, that might be necessary. If, according to that individual, that's within the realm of what the post you might demand from someone. But these were all nuances lost, not understanding that there are various different views amongst the post you. And this is what we call mi'ikar adin, what's necessary according to halacha. And then there are the chumras, which we add if we're able to. But that very often gets lost. It's sort of like that, you know, the halacha, that a woman's not able to make abdallah, which is just and simply untrue. It's a simplification. This, how much matzah you're supposed to eat, is a simplification of the halacha. You know the background in terms of what the poskim said about how much matzah you're supposed to eat. You'll know that that shear is a shear which is a chumrah, which is a stringency. And if you would have asked the Chazon Ish himself, he would have told you it was the stringency. He never meant it, Mi'ikar Adin. His family, they would mention over and over again, the Chazon Ish himself, when he mentioned that larger shear, would always convey that it's a stringency, it's not what is necessary, Mi'ikar Adin. This is where you have situations where people simplify halacha, where nuances are lost, and as a result, you have categorical statements which are made, which very often end up with what I would call, really, and not likely, a violation of the halacha. A person who would advise such a person to eat a large share of matzah, according to the halacha, it's a violation of halacha. It's usur. Not allowed to demand something from someone to make them sick. Another example that is relevant at this point in time, even though I can't discuss it in detail, is somehow that people will say, you know, it's prohibited to buy anything, you know, buy clothing during Sfiras HaOmer. It's not true. Now, a person wants to keep a custom, which is developed from certain sources, to say it is a categorical statement that you're not allowed to buy, let's say, for example, clothing, and therefore, let's say, for example, you have a simcha coming up, you have a bar mitzvah, a bas mitzvah, a wedding, whatever the case might be. I'm not allowed to buy clothing during Sfiras HaOmer. Again, it's a simplification of the halacha, which very often ends up distorting. So you have to know and be careful about this issue, about recognizing when how to present things in the correct fashion, present things with the proper nuances, knowing how to present whether something is considered an obligation, whether it's considered to be a chumrah. I'm going to give one other example in regard to this, in regard to Maaser Kesafim, where very often you'll find that there is there's shiurim which are given and svarim which are written in regard to giving a tenth of one's possessions to tzedakah. And very often there's shailos which are posed in regard to this. Is one of those halachos which has an enormous amount of mazel. Because one thing which is usually skipped over, and when people hear about this, I'm assuming some people here as well, they're usually very shocked, is the whole din of Maaser Kesafim is an advisable, very laudatory minhag, but is not an absolute obligation. And very often that detail, think about that for a moment, it's usually assumed to be like an absolute, that you absolutely have to do Maaser Kesafim. Rather than dealing with that question, which is what I would refer to here as the nuance, it's not a nuance, obviously, but understanding the halacha, the basic, what the halacha is, before getting the details of how you're going to fulfill it, that's something which very often is not even mentioned. It's a nuance, which is lost. It all of a sudden is presented as a clear-cut halacha, and it can have practical ramifications. Very often, I'll give an example in regard to this, where, let's say, somebody has a difficulty paying tuition, and then they say, one of the reasons they have difficulty paying tuition is because I'm giving the following significant amount of money towards my Maaser Kesafim. So, I can't say every posek would say this, but I know if a lot of posekim would say, you can't do that. You're going to take away money from the yeshiva to give my Maaser Kesafim to other causes. My Maaser Kesafim is not an obligation. You have an obligation to pay as much as you can to the yeshiva, because that they said there's a certain bill that you owe. So that's another case where you have, again, a nuance which is lost in terms of understanding the halacha, in terms of understanding whether halacha is absolutely required, whether it's considered to be a chumrah, what is necessary in Ikar Adin. Those are things which are absolutely critical in presentation of halacha. Not simply to present asur, mutter, etc. Very often the nuances and presenting the background of the halacha are critical in order to understand the halacha properly. Another thing which is very important in presentation of halacha, which also is critical for understanding halacha properly, is historical framework. And that means you have to have a basic understanding. I used to do this sometimes at the beginning of the semester, spend about 3 or 4 classes talking about the background of halacha, in other words, historically. You have to know, first of all, the time of the Tanaim, the time of the Amorim. You have to know about the Mishnayos and the time of the Gemara. You have to know the various different works which are written at that time. Then you have to know that there was a time of the Rishonim, there was a time of the Achronim, there was a time of later posting, there was a time of the contemporary posting. Very often what you'll find when people will present various different shiurim and they don't have a grasp in regard to this, they'll mention, let's say, for example, there's a machlokis between, let's say, for example, the Rambam and the Mishnah Berurah. That doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense, but that will happen every once in a while. There's a machlokis, the Mishnah Berurah argue with the Rambam. No, that means that right there and then, there's a misunderstanding of the halacha. There probably was a machlokis Rishonim, or maybe a machlokis Rishonim which wasn't discerned by everyone. There was the view of the Rambam, and the Mishnah Berurah explained that there are various other Rishonim who disagree with the Rambam, and he favors that view in the Rishonim. You almost will never have the Mishnah Berurah saying, I'm arguing by myself with the Rambam. But when you have those kinds of misunderstandings, then again, when you can wind up with or distortions in the law, you have to know, in order to be able to present the halacha properly, you have to know how to show the progression of the halacha through time. In other words, the classical way of presenting a halacha and putting in a proper framework is to say, this is the din as it appears, if it appears in the Gemara already, this is the din as it appears in the Gemara, in this time of the Tanaim Amorim, the mission in the Gemara. Then afterwards, this is what we find in the time of the Rishonim, this is what we find afterwards in the time of the Achronim and the posting of the Shulchan Aruch, and this is what we find among contemporary posting. Sometimes you'll do the reverse. You'll say, this is the Psak of the Mishnah Berurah. Let's try and trace this back to earlier sources. But by and large, in order to be able to understand the halacha properly, in order to be able to understand the nuances, in order to be able to understand what is Me'ikara Din, what is a Chumra, and what is something which is, you know, without any particular basis in halacha per se, but the custom which developed later on. So you have to have that historical framework, and you have to understand what was said in the time of the Rishonim, what was said in later sources as well. Okay. And then finally, in addition to the question of presentation with nuance, of not just presenting things osur and mutter, in addition to having a historical context in terms of knowing the background of the halacha and being able to put it in this historical context and show how it developed over time, you also have to know the who's who amongst posts. One of the, when I was asked to speak about this, this question came up. When you present multiple views halacha lemaisa, so how do you present that? How do you present the various different views? So you have to be very discerning, and sometimes again requires consultation in order to be able to present this properly. Nowadays, very often in the day of the Bar Ilan Siddi, for example, or BBD now, when you're able to look in the Encyclopedia Talmudis, for example, and find various different views. So very often you'll find like all kinds of views all become, in quotation marks, equal. Rav Moshe Feinstein says this, and there's an article in the following journal which said this, and there's a following, and there's a rabbi who was quoted as having said something else, and there was, so all of a sudden you say, it's Machlokes in the Igros Moshe, and something in a journal which I haven't heard of yet. You know, like in other words, I heard there's such a journal. Now, by the way, the Rav who wrote in that journal might be one of the Gedolei Apostolim, might be one of the Gedolei Ador. But on the other hand, you have like lots of different views. So you can say there's 5 views, 3 views, 2 views, whatever the case might be. It's critical to know who these Apostolim are. You don't know, you have to find out. You have to ask. And the stature of the posek, or the who the posek is important for 2 different reasons. Number one, stature per se. Let's say, for example, if you quoted Rav Moshe Feinstein, you have to know that Rav Moshe Feinstein was looked at by the Gedolei Ador of his time as the Gadol Ador. You have to know, by way of example, maybe I'm going to make reference to it shortly, that somebody like the stature of Shlomo Zalman Rabbah, who himself was considered by some maybe the Gadol Ador in Psak Halacha, look at Rav Moshe Feinstein as being in a different league, an entirely different level. You have to know that. You have to know that because then when you present views of other postings, it might be that they weren't really of the stature of Rav Moshe, and stature really matters. And it matters in terms of how we follow in terms of Psak Halacha. You also have to know the relevance of the posek. Let's say, for example, you're the particular issue in halacha, and you find that the posek lives in Netanya, and he wrote a particular sefer, and you found out that in regard to this, the costumes are cool, and you say, you know what? I like this posek. I think, and right there, this child and Ilta Shabbos, What he makes a lot of sense. You've never met him. You don't have his safer. You've never heard of him before. You're never sending any questions to him. You'll never have a conversation with him in your life. What's your relevance? Even and if your audience, you're talking to, you mentioned this particular Pesach Halacha, but they have no relevance to this particular posseh. It might be a view in theory, conceptually. You want to explain why that view makes sense. But in terms of you're quoting posseh because you're trying to say this posseh's opinion matters to you, then you have to vote, quote posseh that matter, that are relevant to that particular audience, that are relevant to yourself. I can't adopt. So every once in a while, now this happens a lot, that there'll be somebody who publishes something or another, a journal, an article, whatever the case might be. I'm never asking this person a question. I've never seen him quoted before, etc. Then I have no right to follow him. If somebody would say to me, somebody who learned from, or Rav Moshe Feinstein said the following, then you often have the opportunity to be able to say, I'm relying on Rav Moshe, I'm following Rav Moshe, I'm following Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, I'm following, let's say, for example, I live in that orbit, I'm following Rav Schechter, I'm in Riverdale, or my husband or my brother lived by Rabbi Willig, I follow Rabbi Willig's Pesach. Somebody who relates to you. So you're saying you're following Pesach, but Posek, who matters to you. It could be that if you had a serious shot, you'd call up that Posek. But if it's a Posek who has no relevance to you in any which way, not directly, not indirectly, then in that case, most of the time we'd say, so that Posek really doesn't have relevance to me. And in that case, the weight of that Posek's opinion per se is diminished enormously. Now, it's important to note, and this is a long conversation, but it's important to note that you have poskim who matter to everybody. Let's say, for example, Rav Moshe Feinstein. Somebody can't say in today's world, Rav Moshe Feinstein, I didn't know him, my family didn't know him, I didn't even live in the same state as him. Right? What's Rav Moshe Feinstein? There's a halachic basis for this. Rav Moshe Feinstein was considered by everyone to be one of the Gedolei Ador, especially in the area of Pesach Halacha. For that reason, he matters to Klal Yisrael. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach matters to Klal Yisrael. Nowadays, you have post-scheme, other post-scheme as well, who matter to Klal Yisrael. Who are they exactly? I didn't bring a list with me, but you can figure out who they are. Some post-scheme matter to everyone, really just about everyone, with rare exceptions. And then you'll have the post-scheme that matter to you because of the orbit you live in. The rabbi of your shul should matter to you as a post-scheme. His opinion should matter. Let's say, for example, a teacher who you, let's say, for example, taught you halacha, and you very often would ask him shaylos, so his position matters. Let's say, for example, you're living in Washington Heights and you're married to somebody in Smicha. So then Rabbi Schechter's position should matter. Rabbi Willer's position should matter. The people who are relevant to you sometimes with people you never met, who might have lived a generation or two or three ago, and they matter a lot. For that reason, the Mishnah Berurah matters to all of us, right, in a very powerful kind of way. And then you have to figure out which poskim really matter to you. And this is very relevant though, a person is giving a shir in halacha. So you have to be able to present those positions in a way that matters to yourself and matters to the audience that you're speaking to. Let me give a couple of examples where there might be very practical issues where you would bring in, let's say, if you're a Shechter, it would matter to you, then you'd bring in his point of view. Brushing teeth on Shabbos, which is a discussion in the contemporary post-game and lots of different points of view about it. So for example, Shechter is very lenient in regard to this, following Rav Soloveitchik, his Rebbe. And then if you're presenting a shir, that's going to be a very important part of the shir. Maybe you would conclude this year with the more lenient position, if you're not necessarily poskening per se, but on the other hand, that would be emphasized powerfully, because Roshefka's point of view is that you can be lenient for the following reasons, following Rav Soloveitchik's point of view, and therefore that has to be given greater weight than, let's say, for example, somebody who has no connection with Roshefka or with Rav Soloveitchik. Let's say, for example, in terms of showering on the second day of Yom Tov, also an issue which is talked about a lot. But again, Rav Schechter has a more lenient point of view in regard to it. So if, let's say, for example, you're giving a shir in the middle of a neighborhood and they say, which Rav Schechter? Right? So then in that case, so then maybe you wouldn't mention his point of view because you're mentioning Rav Schechter's point of view, but they're not asking Rav Schechter their shilas. So then why are you mentioning Rav Schechter then? And then on the other hand, if you're discussing it with an audience and say, oh, Rav Schechter, my Rebbe is Rav Schechter is his Rebbe, or my Rebbe turns to Rav Schechter with a shilas. So I've heard a lot of Rav Schechter talking, or I'm in that world in which Rav Schechter's opinion matters, Rabbi Willis' position. And then you have to make sure to choose the positions that matter. You have to be very discerning in terms of who you're quoting and how much emphasis you give to them. Okay. I'm skipping over a little bit because of time constraints, but let me just say briefly that, again, nuance matters. Presenting things in a historical context matters. Trying to show how the halacha developed over the course of time. And mentioning poskim appropriately matters a lot. The nuance of how you present the various different views in the poskim. Not just saying everybody is on a level playing field and you found the three or four different points of view amongst different poskim, but knowing which poskim matter more to me, which poskim matter less. which post can carry more weight or less weight, which post can should be mentioned or which post you maybe don't have to be mentioned. That's something which is also critical as well. You don't necessarily have to mention everyone, and certainly not to mention everyone and present them as being on equal footing. One other question which was posed when Sarah sent me some of the things which are being discussed in terms of a class in halacha is what about giving the final psak? So generally the answer is, if there's a machlokas, a poskim, amongst the poskim who matter, then the general answer is don't give a final psak. Don't give a final psak. Don't try to give a final psak. Now if on the other hand, let's say for example, it's the rabbi of your shul who has a certain psak and you're giving a shir in the shul, and that's the final psak, so that's the final psak. But by and large, generally it's a good idea to try not to be overly certain in terms of being able to decide what the final halacha is, whether the kula or the chumrah. Generally, that's true. If the poskim that matter, you have Rosh Shlomo Zalman Rabach and Rav Moshe and Rosh Shechter, and you have others who present different points of view, so they can present different points of view. You can present it accurately, appropriately, with the proper emphasis for each one. And then on the other hand, to reach a final conclusion and say, and therefore I think, one has to be very, very careful in regard to that. It's important to note that humility and modesty in Psak Halacha is absolutely critical, even amongst poskim. It sometimes is a very, very important trait. I'll just mention briefly that there is a very interesting tshuva of Rosh Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, which is in the first chelik of the Mincha Shlomo. It's a Simen Ches, where Rav Moshe Feinstein took a particular view in regard to something which very important issue in Hilchos Shabbos about people returning from a life-saving mission after being matzah lefashos. Can they return back home by driving? And Rav Moshe Feinstein has a famous position in which he leans in regard to it. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach vehemently disagreed in regard to it. Very different point of view. And knowing that Rav Moshe already had publicized his position that he was mekel, so it says the footnote at the bottom, that he says, Hineni mefarse ma'amar zeh la'acher sh'agon hanal shlita nosan li rishus al-kach. He asked Rav Moshe's position to disagree with him. That's an astonishing thing. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, who was one of the G'doli Hador, some would have considered him to be the premier posek for themselves. And nonetheless, he had the incredible humility to ask Rav Moshe Feinstein for permission, because he felt that arguing with Rav Moshe was not something which was simple. Very often nowadays, it's done too easily. A person says a particular point of view in terms of Psak Halacha, and then it just doesn't make sense to me. A person has to know, sometimes it doesn't make sense because I'm not in the Madrega necessarily to understand it. And a person has to recognize one's own limitations in terms of how to be able to grasp Halacha on the level of the poskim, the poskim are able to grasp the Halacha on. And therefore, it's very, very important, even if a person feels very strongly, this makes more sense to me, this makes less sense to me, it's very important when presenting various different views in halacha, not necessarily to reach a conclusion, unless, again, you have a particular situation where you're speaking on behalf of someone who's the posek for that organization, or the posek for that shul, or the posek for that school, and you know what the conclusion is supposed to be. So then you present a different point of view and say, over here, we do the following. But on the other hand, it's very important to maintain that sense of humility, and not necessarily to reach one conclusion when there are various different views amongst the posts.
Thank you so much. We'll open up the floor now to the panel for like 20 minutes. So if anyone has questions, comments, or
lectures. You want to call on people?
Yeah. So this is for
I'll be honest with you, a shear that's conversation based, I've never